Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Tonight is episode 15. The date is June 19, 2014. Your hosts are me, Carolyn Yeager.
And me, Ray Goodwin.
And we both agree that we have some really great Hitler talk in this episode, which is from November 1941. I'm really impressed with it. How about you, Ray?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We cover the early struggles of the National Socialist Party versus the Communists, get into the religious aspect, and it's really a fascinating section.
Yeah, he says, I just thought that there were a few passages that were just real jewels.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'll recognize them when we come to them.
Sure.
So we are starting with November 19th tonight, right? And I've mm-hmm. got a November 18th timeline thing. There's two, one for the 18th and the other the 19th. On the 18th, Operation Crusader, the British Commonwealth and other Allied troops crossed into Libya and at least temporarily relieved the siege of Tobruk.
Mm-hmm.
And on the 19th, an Australian light cruiser, the Sydney, and the German auxiliary cruiser, the Cormoran, sunk each other off the coast of Western Australia. All 648 crewmen are lost on the British Sydney.
Hmm.
Say how the Germans did, but obviously they didn't all succumb. I suppose that was a big deal. But anyway, that's what was going on then.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one more thing there too, that you, I think you made mention of this in a previous program. Close to this happening was that U.S. destroyer, the Greer, which was in the Atlantic, and it was monitoring where this German sub was and then sending that information to a British destroyer, and so that British destroyer could track that sub and possibly destroy it. The sub surfaced, and they fired on each other, the U.S. destroyer, the Greer. And, of course, Roosevelt then was quick to get on the air and say that one of our ships innocently sailing in the Atlantic has been fired on by a German submarine. He neglected to mention that submarine, USS Greer, was transmitting location of that German submarine to the British so they could come destroy it.
Hmm. Yeah, there was the U.S. in the war before it got in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Totally, totally illegal behavior by the...
That's right.
All right, well, why don't you get started, Ray?
Okay, 19th November 1941. Above all, it was essential that the party should not allow itself to be overrun by the bourgeois. I took care, by applying appropriate methods, to welcome nobody into it but truly fanatical Germans, ready to sacrifice their private interests to the interests of the public. The bourgeois parties carried their stupidity so far as to claim it that it's always the more intelligent who should yield. I, on the other hand, have always had a single aim, to assert my demands at all costs, come wind, come weather.
Well, there's some of that great stuff.
You know, and I wrote...
so much.
I'm telling you, I wrote true leader right beside that.
Well, you know, I like the use of the word fanatical.
Oh, yes.
You know, he's saying he wanted people that were fanatical, ready to
right.
sacrifice and do what needed to be done. He didn't want any kind of lukewarm. That's what he says is wrong with the bourgeois, the
yes,
bourgeoisie.
Yes.
They're just so, you know, they and just as we know today, you know.
They have the attitude, I'd like to help, but, you know, I'd lose my customers, you know.
Yeah,
stuff
I'll
like
help,
that.
But I can't do anything that's going to
mm-hmm.
ask too much of me and so on.
That's right.
Well, this is what he was saying, and then and it's true, you know. And he had this was considered why he was a fanatic. What was wrong with him? By his critics, that he insisted on having what he wanted. You know,
sure.
He insisted
sure.
on they always called demand. You know, when they did their party platform, wasn't it? It was said we demand
yes.
this, we demand that. They didn't say we want or
that's right
asking for. So.
And it's going to be revealed this evening, too, that had he not been that way, the Reds would have overwhelmed the National Socialist
That's
Party
right.
and put it asunder.
That's right. Okay.
The basic notions that served us in the struggle for power have proved that they are correct and are the same notions as we apply today in the struggle we are waging on a world scale. We shall triumph in this undertaking, likewise, because we fight fanatically for our victory and because we believe in our victory. This sniveling in which some of the bourgeois are indulging nowadays on the pretext that the Jews have to clear out of Germany is just typical of these holier-than-thous. Did they weep when every year hundreds of thousands of Germans had to emigrate from inability to find a livelihood on our own soil? These Germans had no kinsfolk in various parts of the world. They were left to their own mercies. They went off into the unknown. Nothing of that sort for the Jews, who have uncles, nephews, cousins everywhere. In the circumstances, the pity shown by our bourgeois is particularly out of place.
Now I have to intervene again because I think that's so great. I just love it that he says that they didn't care when Germans had to leave country, but when you're going to have the Jews leave, oh, that's just terrible. And that's so true. And both my grandfathers, of course, they didn't come directly from Germany. They already felt they had to leave Germany back in the 1700s, and they went out to Hungary and settled land there and settled there in these German communities. And then they came to the United States, both of them, and they were both the first ones in their family to come, and they didn't have anybody waiting for them. Then they helped bring some of their brothers and sisters came later. But, you know, this is the difference between people who really can take the tough things in life and those who can't.
It's fecundity. But she has not put in their reach, without the need for effort on their part, all the food they need. All that is very right and proper, for it is the struggle for existence that produces the selection of the fittest. The party must continue to be as tough as it was during the conquest of power. It's necessary that the Führer should at all times have the certainty that he can count on the unshakable support of the members of the party, and that he can count on it all the more inasmuch as certain compatriots beneath the weight of circumstances should prove to be waverers. The party cannot drag dead weights with it. It can do nothing with the lukewarm. If there are any such amongst us, let them be expelled. To those who hold in their hands the destinies of the country, it can be a matter of indifference that not all the bourgeois are behind them, but they must have this certainty that the party forms a buttress as solid as granite to support their power.
Well, Ray, somewhere in there, after when I was talking, I guess I went off the air. I went off, had some sight problem, and I heard the sound, but I didn't know what it was. And then when I came back, you were talking. I was talking, and then I heard you were just reading. And so I realized that you didn't hear me. Somewhere I got cut off, but it's okay. I don't need to go back. And well, I don't know what I was saying when you didn't hear me anymore.
You know, I heard an echo-like sound, and I thought, well, I hope that doesn't mean we've lost power, but I couldn't hear you, so I just took off on the reading in case the audience could still hear me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think so, because you were reading when I came back.
Okay, good.
That's the way it seems like it usually goes. I don't know. So, all right, well, what do you want to say about that section?
Well, I think we've commented on the most solid parts of it already, about, you know, they don't want any waverers or snivelers in that party or anybody that's lukewarm. Let them be expelled, because he said that, you know, our people must have this certainty that the party forms a buttress as solid as granite to support their power.
Yeah, let them be expelled. It made me think of that verse, I guess, in Revelation. I'm going to bring this up because it fits. Mm-hmm. Where just those who are in the churches at that time, that's what it was. He said, because you are lukewarm, I spit you out of my mouth. Mm-hmm. He's talking about the hot ones and the cold ones, but the lukewarm ones he hated the most. I imagine Hitler was familiar with that.
Sure.
I don't know. He uses very much the same language there.
That's right.
Yeah. He's pretty much of a big reader, and he read quite a bit of the Bible. I'm not saying he probably didn't read everything in it, but...
Well, he was well-versed in it.
Yes, he was, yeah. So, okay, we're going to go on now to Germany's sense of duty.
Okay, November 20th, 1941. If the mental picture that Christians form of God were correct, the God of the ants would be an ant, and similarly for the other animals. Even for the Bolsheviks, the notion of collective ownership has its limits. Trousers, shirt, handkerchief, for those who have such a thing, are regarded as private property. We Germans have that marvelous source of strength, the sense of duty, which other peoples do not possess. The conviction that, by obeying the voice of duty, one is working for the preservation of the species, helps one to take the gravest decisions. What would have happened if Italy, instead of becoming fascist, had become communist? We ought to be grateful to the Duce for having dispelled this danger from Europe. That's a service he has rendered that must never be forgotten. Mussolini is a man made to the measure of the centuries. His place in history is reserved for him. What doesn't Italy owe to Mussolini? What he has achieved in every sphere, even Rhodes, that island asleep in the Far Niente, he created out of the void. Compare that fertile island with the Greek Isles, and you understand what Mussolini has done for his country.
Yeah, he sure thought a lot of Mussolini. He didn't think that much of all the rest of the Italians, though.
Yeah.
He made a distinction between an Italian like Mussolini, he said, who was still a Roman, and the rest of the Italians who, not that he didn't think there were some good Italians, but... And he was the same with Antonescu, we've discussed
yes,
here.
Yes, Romania.
He thought Antonescu was a great man, but he thought he didn't have the greatest people to lead. He had to lead the Romanians. He wasn't bad. And I don't like to say anything bad about the Romanians. They were some of the best. But,
that's right.
But they weren't, I guess Hitler didn't think they were of the quality of the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
neither the Italians nor the Romanians were of the quality of the German soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But he thought that that some of these leaders were exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
So
his reference to Mussolini here is an excellent segue into the next thing we're going to read, because of course what he's talking about there was the Italian Revolution under Mussolini, mm-hmm. which kicked out the communists, kicked out the mafia, and what a great turn that he had done for Italy. And this next section jumps back into the early days and struggles of the National Socialist Party in the basic German Revolution.
And okay. In the timeline, on the 27th, we already knew that the Battle of Moscow was going on. And on the 27th, it says that the German panzers are on the outskirts of Moscow. But now we're 3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
November 30th, 1941, evening. Special guest, the Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler and General Dietl.
Yeah, and that's Eduard Dietl. He was a great man, a great commander, and he unfortunately got killed in one of those plane crashes that weren't, in battle or anything, just one of those mm-hmm. transport planes that went down. As I recall... But he was only a year younger than Hitler, and he was in both World War One and Two. But he was a hero of the Battle of Norway. He really clinched that win, and that was a very close call that was going on there during mm-hmm. that Battle of Narvik. And he was a commander of mountain divisions and a mountain army, and he joined the DAP and the Freikorps of Franz Ritter von Epp in 1919 after World War One, and he was prepared with his company on 9th November 1923 to support Adolf Hitler and the rebels in the beer hall putsch. And mm-hmm. at the end of this segment here, Hitler refers to that, speaks to him, refers to that, and that's what he's referring to, that mm-hmm. Dietl was in charge of a Freikorps company And he was prepared on November 9th, 1923, to come to the aid of Hitler's group, but because of the way it happened, he didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This, where he jumps to right here is back in the early days of the party, trying to get its feet on the ground and earn German support.
Oh, right. And do you think, I've got a little, just a real little brief thing here about the Battle of Coburg, it wasn't the Battle of Coburg, but the rally there, and mm-hmm. he just starts talking about it, so maybe I should read this so people know what's
sure.
going on. On October 14th, 1922, Adolf Hitler took 800 men and a band, a musical band, to Coburg because something was going on there, and they were invited, so they went, and they went by train, I don't know if they were invited, somebody invited them. And in 1932, he struck a badge called the Coburg Badge to honor that. And in 1929, Coburg was the first German city in which the Nazi Party won the absolute majority of the popular votes during the municipal elections. So, and Coburg's in Bavaria. Right up at the top on the line between the Bavarian, Thuringia? And anyway, it was an important, very important city for them. And this trip, this what he's talking about, was in 1922.
Right. That's good. Coburg, it was the first time we received a positive invitation. I accepted immediately. We must not let such an opportunity escape us. I took 800 men. Others were to join us from Saxony and Thuringia. At Nuremberg, we had our first encounter. Our train, which was beflagged, was not to the taste of some Jews installed in a train halted beside ours. Schreck leapt into the midst of them and started laying about him.
So I guess everybody knows who Schreck was. I don't know. I guess he was one of his close compatriots there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when it says the train is beflagged, I
yes.
figured that means that they had their own flags on the train.
Yes,
that
that's
they had
right.
their own part of the train or something, you know. 800, can you imagine, you know, I mean, what a big group of men he had, and what we have in these days, if we couldn't come up with 800 people to go somewhere.
Yeah, there were swastika banners flying.
Yeah, yeah, right. So, and then they had Jews didn't like it.
Okay. In Coburg Station, the reception committee was waiting for us. Dietrich came hobbling over to me to tell me that he'd made an agreement with the trades unions, by the terms of which we undertook not to march in ranks with flags and music in front of us. I pointed out that he had no authority to give undertakings in my name and that I would pay no attention to them. I ordered the flags and music to go in front, and the procession was formed. When I appeared, I was greeted by the unanimous shout of 1,000 voices, rogues, bandits, a real populace. Things were going to warm up. At once, I put myself at the head. We were led not to the rifle range, but to the Hofbrauhaus. Around us was an innumerable crowd shouting, howling, threatening. When we were inside, Dietrich told me that for the present it was impossible for us to go to our billets. At this moment, the gate of the beer hall was barricaded by the police. Good God, I exclaimed. A policeman came and told me we were forbidden to leave the building since the police declared itself unable to guarantee our protection. I replied that this protection of theirs was of no concern of mine, that we were capable of protecting ourselves, and that I ordered him to open the gate. This he did, but explaining that I was compelling him to bow to force. I said to myself, if I see a single one of our fellows flinch, I'll tear off his brassard. And that brassard is it's a band with an identifying mark worn on the sleeve, so obviously he was talking about that swastika banner on the sleeves of these fellows. Once we were outside, we gave them such a thrashing that in 10 minutes' time the street was cleared. All our weapons came in useful. Our musicians' trumpets came out of the affray twisted and dented. The Reds were scattered and fled in all directions. We slept on straw. During the night, I learnt that a group of my supporters had been attacked. I sent a few men to the rescue, and soon afterwards, three Reds were brought back to me, three Reds whose faces were no longer human. It was at this moment that a policeman confided to me, "You can't imagine how we suffer under the domination of these dogs. If only we'd known that you'd settle their hash like that." I told him that this was the special treatment we reserved for the rabble. Next day, all of the talk was of Bavarian gangsters who had broken into the town. Leaflets were distributed in the street, inviting the population to a counter-manifestation. At the hour stated, we were on the scene. We saw about 150 Reds assembling, but at the sight of us, they took flight. We then went in procession to the citadel and came down again from it. I'd ordered my men to strike down the first man who hesitated. After our return, we were greeted with cheers from all the windows. The bourgeoisie had regained courage. That evening, at the Hofbrauhaus, the citizens were rejoicing at the thought that the devil's fangs had been drawn. Jürgen von Rehman was there. I said to him, "That's typical of your bourgeois world, cowards at the moment of danger, boasters afterwards." "We fight with the weapons of the spirit," he replied. "They'll do you a lot of good, your spiritual weapons," Dietrich said with a shout of laughter. "Excuse me," Raymond replied, "you forget that I'm a descendant of Bismarck," on which I observed that one couldn't blame Bismarck for having such a scion. For our return to Munich, the railwaymen's trade union told us that it refused to give us transport. "Very well," I said to their delegates. "I'll start by taking you as hostages, and I'll have a roundup of all your people who fall into our hands. I have locomotive drivers amongst my men. They'll drive us. And I'll take you all on board with us. If anything at all happens, you will accompany us into the other world." Thereupon, I had them all rounded up, and a half hour later, the proletariat decided to let us go. At that date, it was indispensable to act without hesitations. It was the beginning of a new era. At Munich, an action was brought against us on the pretext that at Coburg we had severely wounded a number of manifestors. It was even said that we had used machine guns. In reality, somebody had confused a music stand with a machine gun. The affair was pigeonholed. Later on, the Reds we had beaten up became our best supporters. When the Falange imprisons its opponents, it's committing the gravest of faults. Wasn't my party at the time of which I'm speaking composed of 90% of left-wing elements? I needed men who could fight. I had no use for the sort of timid doctrinaires who whisper subversive plans into your ear. I preferred men who didn't mind getting their hands dirty.
Yeah, now the Falange is Spanish political movements and parties. Actually, there's more than one, but they were kind of a number of them, but they're all called the Falange in the late 1930s. So they are a late contemporary of German and Italian fascism.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Bearing in mind our origins, one can only be stupefied by the results obtained in 4 years. I had Munich, and I controlled a newspaper. The press hostile to us had a total circulation 10 times greater than ours. Our printer, Adolf Mueller, a man of an infinite flexibility of views, had printed them all. He had a number of communists on his staff and was in the habit of saying to them that if anything displeased them in the activities of the firm, he would offer to pay them their week's wages in orthodox opinions instead of in money. This Mueller was a self-made man. There was a period when he was constantly coming to demand money from us. We were convinced that he was exploiting us, and for this reason, Amon used every week to wage a war to the knife against him with the object of making him lower his rates.
Yeah, Amon was, well, before Goebbels came along and did it, I guess, but he was running the newspaper.
The best trick I played on him was the adoption of the large format for the Bolkischer Beobachter. Mueller had thought himself the cunning one, for he supposed that by being the only man who possessed a machine corresponding to our new format, he was binding us to him. In reality, it was he who was binding himself to our newspaper, and he was very glad to continue to print for us, for no other newspaper used our format. Mueller had become the slave of his machine. Moreover, we were the only newspaper that never had a fall in circulation. It was a piece of luck that we didn't have our own printing shop, for the party comrades who would have been our customers would have needed a lot of coaxing to make them pay their bills. What about party solidarity, they'd have said. In his own way, Adolf Mueller was a good sort. He looked carefully after the well-being of his employees, and he always defended his workers' interests even before the labor front existed. Himself an offspring of the people, he knew how to practice the art of live and let live. It's at this period that we laid the first foundations of our present Reich. When I think of the persecutions we met with, newspapers suspended, meetings forbidden or sabotaged, seen in retrospect, this was the golden age of our struggle. My entry into the chancellery marks the end of that inspiring life. Until then, 9 out of 10 of the men with whom I was in contact belonged to the people. From that moment onwards, 9 out of 10 belonged to distinguished society. It was a turning upside down of my entire existence. Today, I once more find the old contact with the people in popular gatherings. Addressing Dietl, the Führer continued, "All that, I owe it to you, for at the origin of the movement, it was with your men that you permitted me to act. To tell the truth, you contributed to the birth of the Third Reich. I understand why the bourgeois bristle at the prospect of being governed by people like us. Compared with us, the Social Democrats numbered in their ranks men with much better outward qualifications, from the point of view of the bourgeois, I mean. The bourgeois could only be terrified as they witnessed the coming of this new society, but I knew that the only man who could be really useful to us was the man capable of mounting on the barricades." Turning towards Hewell, the Führer went on, 1923, at that period you already had magnificent uniforms, but 1920-22, the uniform was indispensable. With some people well-dressed and others miserably, one cannot build a coherent formation. It's difficult to imagine that sort of thing nowadays. It's because I'm aware of all that I know, too, that our movement is inimitable. What has happened in our midst is something unique, inconceivable in France, for example, and the French will never have a chief like the Duce. So,
well, that's very good. I'm checking my email now. I've got, you want to comment on any of that, Ray?
No, that's all right. Go right ahead.
I don't have any notice. I guess people continue to hear us just fine. Well, particularly this last part here about the uniforms, I really like hearing about that, because all we hear today is complaints about how they wore uniforms back then. We mm-hmm. don't want to wear any uniforms. You know, gosh, you know, that looks terrible and that's stupid. But he said, and very rightly so, that, well, they always paraded in those days. You know, that was, everybody did that. And you marched around. Had flags. They said you couldn't do that with everybody dressed in their own clothes. Mm-hmm. And some people, if you say, well, let's all wear dark pants and white shirts mm-hmm. and something, well, some people's will be look good and other people's will look poor, because they had all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about school uniforms on Monday. and you know, to me, it's the same thing, that in school, mm-hmm. you have students are more concerned, especially girls, about how they're dressed and
right.
get into that too, and or how they look and everything, than in taking their lessons seriously and so on. Mm-hmm. And it's also very distracting, and a lot of people can't keep up, and so it's very class conscious and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, I could talk about that for a long time. But that's why I'm such a believer in school uniforms. Mm-hmm. I don't think anything looks better than to see little kids, particularly younger kids, but even if they're high school students, because that's when they really need to be concerned about their clothes when they're going to school, dressed in their nice, neat uniforms. And they're not really uniforms. They're just, but they're, mm-hmm. They're all the same. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's exactly right, and it takes the focus off of them competing with each other as to who's dressed better, who's wearing the more expensive clothing and things like this. And, when he mentions those uniforms back then, of course, if they're marching with uniforms on and carrying their flags, that's unity and that's power. And the image that they gave then, a lot of the German populace was afraid that the country might go communist because the red activity was really, really frequent then. And they were taking over various towns by intimidating the town officials. And the only party that would stand up to them was the National Socialist Party. And when the National Socialist Party exhibited that unity of uniforms and flags, and they went after the Reds who had attacked them, with fists, and the Reds had broken up other party meetings of other parties, but when they tried to break up the National Socialist Party meetings, they got the hell kicked out of them. And as he mentioned there, the people were cheering them, once they came back. People who had been booing and hollering insults at them saw what they did, and they were cheering them. So, and I think the uniforms and flags played a tremendous role in that.
Oh, yeah, and it makes me think of Leopold Wenger archive that I have at my website. In the early days, when he was a young Hitler Youth leader, he kept a diary or a journal, and he was very good about writing all this stuff down, particularly during the time prior to the Germans coming in and the Anschluss taking place. He gives you that same feeling. The people would stay like neutral. But then once the Hitler Youth came out ahead, then a lot of people would come out and cheer and celebrate. But that's how it is. You have these fanatics who are out there doing the hard part, and mm-hmm. the rest of the townspeople and the regular people are watching to see how it turns out.
That's right.
Now, when it turns out well, they'll say, well, we liked you all along. And maybe they did.
Mm-hmm.
But that's never going to change. And when they all wore uniforms, and they loved their uniforms. They were very
sure. proud of
them. Well, okay. So now we're going to go on to the 1st and 2nd of December, and I've got a timeline here for December 1st, 1941. Malta marks its 1,000th bombing raid. So they're doing a lot of heavy bombing of Malta?
Yes, they were trying to take that away from the British. But, I wondered if there may be an airfield on Malta that the Germans used once they took it over. And so they launched bombing raids from there.
I never heard anything about what Malta was doing. Much so, I didn't check further into that, though.
Mm-hmm.
But Fiorello LaGuardia, that mayor of New York,
mm-hmm.
published Administrative Order Number 9, creating the Civil Air Patrol for U.S. Coastal Patrol and naming its national commander Major General John F. Curry. They changed the Civil Air Patrol to the U.S. Coastal Patrol, and we're getting that ready.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, we go to the night of the 1st and 2nd of December 1941. Walter Huell questioned whether it was right to reproach a woman for not having taken the decision after 1933 to obtain a divorce from a Jewish husband. He questioned, incidentally, whether the desire to obtain a divorce in such circumstances did not rather betoken a conformism that, from the human point of view, was not very creditable. G.D. interposed that the fact that a German woman had been capable of marrying a Jew was the proof of a lack of racial instinct on her part, and that one could infer from this the fact that she had ceased to form a part of the community.
Now, before we get to what the Fuhrer says, this mm-hmm. second is the hard line, and we hear these same things today.
Right.
Same argument, exactly. that
That's
those
right.
who say, well, you know, if somebody married a Jew, even if they didn't know about
mm-hmm.
Jews, then they still, they had some kind of failure of their,
mm-hmm.
of what racial instinct that they should have. And then the other side is that, well, you couldn't expect, if a woman divorced her husband or left her family or a man did or something, once the Nuremberg laws came into effect, and that would show you're just going along with the crowd, and it doesn't show you to be treating your family right. You should be
mm-hmm.
put up with that. And so I thought that for that reason that was very interesting. Because
sure.
I've heard that discussion so much.
Oh, yeah.
But the Fuhrer does what?
I think his answer here was really, really perfect. It says, the Fuhrer interrupted. Don't say that. 10 years ago, our intellectual class hadn't the least idea of what a Jew is. And, you know, to me, what that means right there is they looked at the Jew just like another German.
Well,
and
a lot of them did. He says the intellectual
yeah.
class. I kind of wondered about that because it happened in 1933, or maybe he's talking about 1941, which is the present time. And he says 10 years ago, they didn't have the least idea what a Jew is. So in 1931, mm-hmm. they didn't. Well, that's not really, some people wouldn't have distinguished, but a lot of people did know.
Yes. But to me, what that remark meant was we shouldn't fault everybody. You know, that maybe a German woman married a Jew because if she was ignorant of, you know, of what the Jew was really all about, well, she made a mistake.
That's
you know,
right. He didn't want to go on a witch hunt about it.
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's good wording.
Yeah.
And he says, obviously, our racial laws demand great strictness on the part of the individual, but to judge of their value, one mustn't let oneself be guided by particular cases. It is necessary to bear in mind that in acting as I do, I am avoiding innumerable conflicts for the future. I am convinced that there are Jews in Germany who've behaved correctly, in the sense that they've invariably refrained from doing injury to the German idea. It's difficult to estimate how many of them there are, but what I also know is that none of them has entered into conflict with his co-racialists in order to defend the German idea against them. I remember a Jewess who wrote against Eisner in the Bayerischer Courier, but it wasn't in the interest of Germany that she became Eisner's adversary, but for reasons of opportunism. She drew the attention to the fact that if people persevered in Eisner's path, it might call down reprisals on the Jews. It's the same tune as in the Fourth Commandment. As soon as the Jews lay down an ethical principle, it's with the object of some personal gain.
Well, again, maybe we should talk about this.
I think that's a good
right
idea.
This is the same thing as we say today. Whether these some Jews, whether Jews understand the damage that all Jews as a group do to
mm-hmm.
to the Germans, some would and some wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I think he's really, as he, when he says here he's trying to avoid conflicts for the future, he's trying to set out the rules so that people from here on in could follow and do the right thing, not to go and punish people who have already
mm-hmm.
made some of these relationships. Then he says that so often, Jews don't criticize themselves ever, you know. If they,
mm-hmm.
If they don't stand up against these kind of Jews, then it's going to be bad for all the Jews. So again,
mm-hmm.
it's in the interest of the Jews, he's saying. It's not hardly ever in the interest of Germans.
Yeah, and when he mentions that Jewish that wrote that letter criticizing, and that would be Kurt Eisner, who was working hand-in-hand with that Spartacist movement, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, which was stirring up communist activity in all over Germany, really. And Eisner was just a communist revolutionary. And when that Jewish took him to task in a letter to the editor, I'm assuming, Hitler correctly says she didn't do that to defend the interests of Germany. She was an opportunist because she was a Jew criticizing a Jew. And then he says it's the same tune as in the Fourth Commandment, which had to do with having no gods before me, no work on Sunday, no worship of idols, and et cetera. But, you know, he says it's the object of some personal gain.
Well, yeah, because some of them are aware that some of these Jews act in such a way that's going to bring down anger on all the Jews.
Right.
That's been done in the past. That's what they call those pogroms, you know, when the Jews just kept pushing, and finally the people pushed back. The Christian people pushed back, and then the Jews called it a pogrom, and they were just attacked for no reason. But but you know what's interesting is that we have the same thing going on today in these arguments and the same discussion. And here we could go to see what Hitler said, and we could get his answer, and maybe we could, of course, a lot of people don't want to listen to Hitler, but if we did, you know, we could come to some finality about things.
Mm-hmm.
We could get his view on it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that he had said a lot of these things, so I think it's very good, and I'm going to keep it for future reference.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he's referencing, like we've already talked about, the bourgeoisie being fence straddlers and watching to see which way the wind is going to blow and coming down on that side if they come off of that fence. You know, he's putting Jews in that they may not openly support their fellow Jews and their communist activities or whatever, but they're sitting there waiting to see, especially when the National Socialist Party was born and started resisting this stuff and started gaining a personal following by an awful lot of Germans. Then they started thinking, you know what, we better not come down on the side of our brethren here. Let's wait and see, because there's a resistance against this growing in Germany, and let's continue to ride that fence and maybe offer a little criticism of our people here. And it was just all in self-interest.
Well, and I'm glad you continued on with that, because it allowed me to remember that I wanted to say that people that I put in this category today, and I'm one of the few that wants to do this, are the very popular Gilad Atzmon and then that fellow Paul Eisen. They're both two people that everybody goes gaga over. Oh, they're such great Jews. It just goes to show that we don't want to have collective judgment against Jews, because they're not all the same. And they're not, well, these, to me, and you might have feel good about these two people. Most people do, but to me, they're in that same category, that exactly that what they're doing, and they may not be fully conscious of it. They may not have started out for that reason, but this is the role that they're playing, is that they're helping not to bring reprisals down on the Jews and also on Israel. They're both backers of Israel, and they say so.
Yeah. You know, my personal feeling on that, Carolyn, is falling back on the old adage of a leopard can't change its spots or a wolf in sheep's clothing. I have no trust of people like that until I've been taught better, and I'm very wary of that sort of thing, trusting those people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and then just recently I read, again, this wrong information that somebody put in a comment. And I think I'm not going to say where I think it was. It was on some forum or something. And this person said, Gilad Atzmon is not a Jew. He's rejected being a Jew. Well, I thought that at one time myself, but then I found out it wasn't true. He kind of talked like that once in some famous column he wrote, but he went back on it, and he does consider himself a Jew. And they're against Israel, but they only want to change the rulership of Israel. They don't want to get rid of Israel. They don't want to get rid of anything, and they want Jews to be free to be in all these, you know, all around the world like they are, and they want to think of Jews as religion and so on. They want to do all this stuff. They just go, and they go after the right wing, and therefore they go after Nazism, and they accuse the Israelis, present-day Israelis, of acting like Nazis.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the whole thing is screwed.
It is. Okay, carrying on here. Probably many Jews are not aware of the destructive power they represent. Now, he who destroys life is himself risking death. That's the secret of what's happening to the Jews. Whose fault is it when a cat devours a mouse? The fault of the mouse, who has never done any harm to a cat?
Yeah, now, in case people aren't quick enough on that, like I was, and I had to think about it a little bit, the cat is the Jew.
That's right.
The Germans are the mouse.
Okay. This destructive role of the Jew has, in a way, a providential explanation. If nature wanted the Jew to be the ferment that causes people to decay, thus providing these people with an opportunity for a healthy reaction, in that case, people like St. Paul and Trotsky are, from our point of view, the most valuable. By the fact of their presence, they provoke the defensive reaction of the attacked organism. Dietrich Eckart once told me that in all his life he had known just one good Jew, Otto Weininger, who killed himself on the day he realized that the Jew lives upon the decay of peoples. It is remarkable that the half-caste Jew to the second or third generation has a tendency to start flirting again with pure Jews. But from the seventh generation onward, it seems the purity of the Aryan blood is restored. In the long run, nature eliminates the noxious elements.
Boy, that's a long time to wait. The seventh generation.
Yeah, seventh generation. You know, you're talking about.
And that was like, wow, you go past 132nd, 164th, and I think it's the next one after that or something. So where I guess you feel they feel that you're back to being an Aryan again.
Mm-hmm.
So it just makes you think that if you're concerned about racial purity or racial, you know, keeping your race not necessarily pure, but, you know. Sure.
Yeah, preservation of the species.
Yeah, all of that.
Like people,
Then what a foolish thing it is to ever breed with someone of another race, because you've thrown away something that you have there, and it takes forever to get it back again. And it's very unlikely that your offspring are going to follow that and get back to that, you know.
Right, and he's talking 150 years there, you know.
Okay, that's good. That's good to put it that way. Seven generations, 150 years. Wow. You know, when he says things like this, too, and there's more of it in what we're reading tonight, it shows again how concerned he was, this racial thing.
Oh, yeah. One may be repelled by this law of nature which demands that all living things should mutually devour one another. The fly is snapped up by a dragonfly, which itself is swallowed by a bird, which itself falls victim to a larger bird. This last, as it grows old, becomes a prey to microbes, which end by getting the better of it. These microbes, in their turn, find their predestined ends. If we had more powerful microscopes, we would discover new worlds. In the absolute, moreover, nothing is either great or small. Things are big or little by the standard one selects. What is certain in any case is that one cannot change anything in all of that. Even a man who takes his own life returns finally to nature, body, soul, and mind. The toad knows nothing of his previous existence as a tadpole, and our own memory serves us no better as regards our own previous state. That's why I have the feeling that it's useful to know the laws of nature, for that enables us to obey them. To act otherwise would be to rise in revolt against heaven. If I can accept a divine commandment, it's this one: thou shalt preserve the species. The life of the individual must not be set at too high a price. If the individual were important in the eyes of nature, nature would take care to preserve him. Amongst the millions of eggs a fly lays, very few are hatched out, and yet the race of flies thrives. What is important for us who are men is less the sum of knowledge acquired than the maintenance of conditions that enable science constantly to renew itself. Nobody is compelled to consider life from a point of view that makes it unworthy to be lived. Man has a gift for seizing hold of what is beautiful. And what inexhaustible riches the world contains for the man who knows how to enjoy his senses. Moreover, nature has given man the desire to make others share in the joys he feels. The beautiful always claims its right to primacy. Otherwise, how is one to explain the fact that in periods of misfortune, so many beings are ready to sacrifice their lives simply to ensure the continuity of their race? The catastrophe for us is that of being tied to a religion that rebels against all the joys of the senses. Apropos of that, the hypocrisy of the Protestants is worse than that of the Catholics. Protestantism has the warmth of the iceberg. The Catholic Church, that still has its 1,000 years of experience and has not lost contact with its Jewish origins, is obviously more adroit. She permits the orgies of carnival. Firstly, because she is powerless to prevent them, and secondly, because she recaptures the sinner on Ash Wednesday. By picturing to him the sufferings of hell, she succeeds in inciting him to be properly generous. After periods of repentance, there's room for relaxation.
Well, so what do you want to say first?
Well, what that section right there for me means, Carolyn, is Hitler's total respect for nature and the laws of nature, and that man can be the fly in the ointment primarily because of religion. Because to him, you know, the way I interpret his words and everything, religion is anti-nature. And if you go anti-nature, you're not long for this earth.
Yeah, and apart from just being nature, it's natural law in the sense that God is revealed in natural law. Somewhere he said, must have been last week, that no religion can go against natural law and be believed.
That's right.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's, you know, we're aware of that. And where'd that come from? It didn't come from some kind of devil or man didn't create it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
This is the greatest thing that we know. And he also, to me, reveals that, again, that I think he believes in reincarnation. Or he, I don't know if he'd say he believes in it, but he's quite open to it because of where he said, your previous existence, the toad. He's talking about the toads again, knows mm-hmm. nothing of his previous existence, and we don't either. It, mm-hmm. You know, indicating that he thinks we might have a previous existence. That's why I look at it.
Right, and you know, when he talks about natural law, I can't help but think of how we as a people are affected, like when we're watching something on National Geographic, and maybe it's a lion is chasing an antelope, and immediately when we look at that, I think most people's senses go to, well, I sure hope that antelope escapes,
mm-hmm.
And maybe it does. But then the camera flashes back to the den of the lioness and her four or five cubs that are going to starve to death if she doesn't make that kill.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're brought home to the reality of nature. There's no right. There's no wrong. It is what it is. And Hitler repeats that sort of thing throughout what we've studied so far.
Yes. Yeah, we have to understand that. So he's almost like saying, well, he says nature is neutral about it all.
Mm-hmm, that's
nature
right.
Nature doesn't weep or anything. And by that, he means it would mean also that God doesn't, and that mm-hmm. people in churches doing all this weeping and so on are just irrelevant to to reality. You know, it's not going to make any difference.
Sure. And when he said that a while ago that if, you know, the Christians have the man, like man in God created man in his own image or whatever, and so the Christian view of what God looks like, if you apply that everywhere, then the God of the ants is going to be an ant, the God of the gorilla be a gorilla, and so on and so on. And I think that's extremely pertinent. What he's saying there is by taking such a viewpoint, you are limiting, very, very putting a limitation on what you should think and believe. You're putting a frame around that picture, in other words, and it's limiting your view. Anyway, that's
can't not do that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody sees its own. An ant is not going to see things as a human being.
Sure.
You know, They're only going to see things as ants, not that they think about that. I don't think they do, but who knows. All right, so we'll go on timeline. December 13th, Hungary declares war on the United States and the United Kingdom. The United. Now, we've already had, of course, December 8th. We passed that by. December 7th, I mean, the Japanese Pearl Harbor attack, and then we had... I don't know, when did Germany declare war on the United States? Probably already, huh? Because
I remember, it was December 9th.
Okay, December 9th, good for you. Mm-hmm. And then on the 13th, Hungary declared war on the United States and the United Kingdom. And the United States and the United Kingdom reciprocated and declared war on Hungary. Mm-hmm. Japanese, under General Yamashita, continue their push into Malaya. Under General Homma, the Japanese forces are firmly established in the northern Philippines, and Hong Kong is threatened. So here we are on December 13th, 1941, midday. Mm-hmm. And we've got some great special guests, and I've got a little further information on them. If you want to read their names, I got some first names here. Or you want me to read them?
Go right ahead.
The special guest for this day is Ribbentrop. We know him, Joachim, the foreign minister, German, and Alfred Rosenberg, the Reich mm-hmm. leader, and Joseph Goebbels, doesn't need any identification, and Joseph Terboven, who was the Reichskommissar for Norway. He was a man who was born in Germany, but he was Norwegian, and he was a National Socialist. Anyway, they made him Reichskommissioner once in Norway, occupied Norway, and Reichsleiter Philip Bühler, chief of the chancellery. Now, Bühler was also a medical man, or in any case, he was also in the SS, and he was put in charge of the what they call the Action T4 program, for which he got in big trouble later. And he committed suicide, though. He's a good-looking man, young-looking at the time of the picture that they took. He never did mm-hmm. get all that old. Very nice-looking man, I think, upstanding person, mm-hmm. Too. And he was in Allied custody. At some point after the war, he managed to commit suicide. Mm-hmm. So he is one who evaded the Nuremberg Tribunal, I suppose.
Right.
Good for him. Anyway, they're all there.
Okay.
There's a lot going on at this time.
Absolutely. The war will be over one day. I shall then consider that my life's final task will be to solve the religious problem. Only then will the life of the German native be guaranteed once and for all. I don't interfere in matters of belief. Therefore, I can't allow churchmen to interfere with temporal affairs. The organized lie must be smashed. The state must remain the absolute master. When I was younger, I thought it was necessary to set about matters with dynamite. I've since realized that there's room for a little subtlety. The rotten branch falls of itself. The final state must be, in St. Peter's chair, a senile officiant. Facing him, a few sinister old women, as gaga and as poor in spirit as anyone could wish. The young and healthy are on our side. Against a church that identifies itself with the state, as in England, I have nothing to say. But even so, it's impossible eternally to hold humanity in bondage with lies. After all, it was only between the 6th and 8th centuries that Christianity was imposed on our people by princes who had an alliance of interest with the Shavelings. Our people had previously succeeded in living all right without this religion. I have 6 divisions of SS composed of men absolutely indifferent in matters of religion. It doesn't prevent them from going to their death with serenity in their souls. Christ was an Arian, and St. Paul used his doctrine to mobilize the criminal underworld and thus organized a proto-Bolshevism. This intrusion upon the world marks the end of a long reign, that of the clear Greco-Latin genius. What is this God who takes pleasure in only seeing men grovel before him? Try to picture yourselves the meaning of the following quite simple story. God creates the conditions for sin. Later on, he succeeds with the help of the devil in causing man to sin. Then he employs a virgin to bring into the world a son who, by his death, will redeem humanity. I can imagine people being enthusiastic about the paradise of Muhammad, but as for the insipid paradise of the Christians, in your lifetime you used to hear the music of Richard Wagner. After your death, it will be nothing but hallelujahs, the waving of palms, children of an age for the feeding bottle, and hoary old men. The man of the aisles pays homage to the forces of nature, but Christianity is an invention of sick brains. One could imagine nothing more senseless nor any more indecent way of turning the idea of the Godhead into a mockery. A Negro with his taboos is crushingly superior to the human being who seriously believes in transubstantiation. I begin to lose all respect for humanity when I think that some people on our side, ministers or generals, are capable of believing that we cannot triumph without the blessing of the church. Such a notion is excusable in little children who have learnt nothing else. For 30 years, the Germans tore each other to pieces simply in order to know whether or not they should take communion in both kinds. There's nothing lower than religious notions like that. From that point of view, one can envy the Japanese. They have a religion which is very simple and brings them into contact with nature. They've succeeded even in taking Christianity and turning it into a religion that's less shocking to the intellect. By what would you have me replace the Christian's picture of the beyond? What comes naturally to mankind is the sense of eternity, and that sense is at the bottom of every man. The soul and the mind migrate just as the body returns to nature. Thus life is eternally reborn from life. As for the why of all of that, I feel no need to rack my brains on the subject. The soul is unplumbable. If there is a God, at the same time as he gives man life, he gives him intelligence. By regulating my life according to the understanding that is granted me, I may be mistaken, but I act in good faith. The concrete image of the beyond that religion forces on me does not stand up to examination. Think of those who look down from high upon what happens on earth. What a martyrdom for them to see human beings indefatigably repeating the same gestures and inevitably the same errors. In my view, H.S. Chamberlain, that's Houston Stuart Chamberlain, historian, was mistaken in regarding Christianity as a reality upon the spiritual level. Man judges everything in relation to himself. What is bigger than himself is big. What is smaller is small. Only one thing is certain, that one is part of the spectacle. Everyone finds his own role. Joy exists for everybody. I dream of a state of affairs in which every man would know that he lives and dies for the preservation of the species. It's our duty to encourage that idea. Let the man who distinguishes himself in the service of the species be thought worthy of the highest honors. What a happy inspiration to have kept the clergy out of the party. On the 21st of March, 1933, at Potsdam, the question was raised, with the church or without the church? I conquered the state despite the malediction pronounced on us by both creeds. On that day, we went directly to the tomb of the kings, whilst the others were visiting religious services. Supposing that at that period I'd made a pact with the churches, I'd today be sharing the lot of the Duce. By nature, the Duce is a free thinker, but he decided to choose the path of concessions. For my part, in his place, I'd have taken the path of revolution. I'd have entered the Vatican and thrown everybody out, reserving the right to apologize later. Excuse me, it was a mistake. But the result would have been they'd have been outside. When all is said, we have no reason to wish that the Italians and Spaniards should free themselves from the drug of Christianity. Let's be the only people who are immunized against the disease.
He says a lot of good individual things. Well, here's one thing. He says I have six divisions of SS composed of men absolutely indifferent in matters of religion. Well, I've heard people say, well, the SS was totally anti-Christian and totally
barbarian,
or something
if you will.
Like that,
yeah.
You know.
That's right, pagan.
But I've always doubted it. I mean, all the SS, none of them were, I never could quite accept that. But now here's Hitler saying it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was true, but maybe they just didn't practice it in the SS, and they didn't talk about it, but that doesn't mean some of them wouldn't have still been anyway, believed that way if they wanted to. But, this statement here, but Christianity is an invention of sick brains, that's one of the things that gets people, you know, really upset,
oh, yeah.
Those famous ones.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I believe now, I'm pretty convinced now that he did really feel this way. And again, this was 1941, not 1921 or 1925 or 28, when I don't think he thought that way. But then when he became a chancellor, he tried to work with the churches. He wanted to go along with this German Christianity. And when they finally wouldn't cooperate the way he wanted, he got kind of turned off to them. And I don't think he had anything good to say about them after that.
A couple of things that I came out of this with was this blast against Christianity comes a week after the United States has entered the war. And, of course, the United States preaching that God is on our side, onward Christian soldiers against the Hun, and things like this. I think that has crossed his mind, and it's irked him about a war of Christianity against him and his country. And I just felt like maybe that prompted some of these things that he's saying.
Well, that's very possible. I think a lot of things prompt it. Yeah, sometimes I think he just doesn't want to talk about the serious events, and so he gets on something else and talks about it. So there, we don't really know all the reasons, but
yeah.
I can see how he doesn't like it that the churches had become kind of opposition, or were sponsoring a lot of opposition anyway. They weren't all opposition.
Well, yeah, see, that's what he's talking about when he says the Duce made the mistake of making concessions instead of... He's looking at the Vatican as a nest of opposition right in the middle of Italy, that is providing opposition to the Duce and his government. And he made a pact with them, meaning
right.
Mussolini. And Hitler sees that as a danger with that power entity, right there working against Mussolini.
Hitler, well, people keep saying that Hitler was a pragmatist, Hitler was practical and all that. Well, of course he was. You have to be. But at the same time, he was really strict. He didn't want to compromise. And he saw everybody else as compromising.
Mm-hmm.
And so much more than he wanted to do.
Yeah, and he saw that compromising as a very important danger.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was pretty much of a purist in his ideas. That's why he used words like fanatical. And Mussolini did. He had to share government with the church.
Mm-hmm.
They were very powerful there, and he had to go along with that.
Right.
Another,
we got a real short one here.
Okay, and this is December 14th, and what happened on December 14th was that the British cruiser HMS Galatia, is sunk by U-557 off Alexandria, beginning a series of naval defeats for the Allies. Well, a U-boat sunk a British cruiser off of Egypt. All right.
Okay, December 14th, 1941, midday. Special guests, Rosenberg, Bueller, and Himmler. Kerl, and that's K-E-R-R-L, with the noblest of intentions, wanted to attempt a synthesis between National Socialism and Christianity. I don't believe the thing's possible, and I see the obstacle in Christianity itself. I think I could have come to an understanding with the popes of the Renaissance. Obviously, their Christianity was a danger on the practical level, And on the propaganda level, it continued to be a lie, but a pope, even a criminal one, who protects great artists and spreads beauty around him, is nevertheless more sympathetic to me than the Protestant minister who drinks from the poisoned spring. Pure Christianity, the Christianity of the catacombs, is concerned with translating the Christian doctrine into facts. It leads quite simply to the annihilation of mankind. It is merely wholehearted Bolshevism under a tinsel of metaphysics. Well, there's more firm statement.
Yeah, that's strong, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was just having the thought here. Now, I'll just say, though, that Carroll, K-E-R-R-L, had been put in charge of creating this National German Church. That was with the Protestants, though. Mm-hmm. And Hitler supported him and was behind it all, and I think he hoped that that could be done. But it didn't work out, and now he says, at this date, you know, after that's been given up, I don't believe the thing's possible. Well, he did probably had to believe it was possible at the time, but it wasn't possible. Now he says it's not, and he holds Christianity to blame for that. And now that he's in this war, and now it's gone into Russia, and even though it's starting out real well, he realizes what he's in for here. Well, he's got to, and that... He's more irritated at the churches than ever, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Realizing
right.
that if they're not going to help, they're actually on the side of the enemy when you come right down to it. In many cases,
right.
And he's got this Jewish problem, and he's trying to do something about that. And of course, they're putting a stop to that. They're putting a, what do you put them? You put a spoke in the wheel or something.
Yeah, throwing a wrench into the
works. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he's developing more of a negative and a bad feeling toward Christianity. It's not something he can ignore, because you'd think, well, why doesn't he just leave it alone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to talk about it all the time, or he doesn't have to, you know, have all these opinions. It's just the religion. But he sees it as having more influence than he would like it to have, in the wrong kind of influence. So...
Mm-hmm.
So he keeps going on about it. And I think from his point of view, he's justified.
Yeah, I do too. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I was just going to mention that back in the 1960s, when I first started delving into this stuff and becoming more aware, through a series of circumstance, I wrote a letter to the editor of the local paper, and somebody saw that letter, and I don't even remember the gist of it now, but it was, we need to take a closer look at reality when we study World War II. This fella contacted me, and we became friends, and he introduced me to an old German couple here in where I live, with the last name of Richter. And they both still had the heavy German accents. They had come over in the 1950s, and they were elderly, at that time. And I sat and talked with them one evening when we got together, and the man's wife said, you know, when we were talking about World War II, she said, when the United States got in that war, we felt like we could not win it. And she said that was a feeling that started to creep into the German civilian population. And, you know, I don't know. It's her opinion, and they were in Germany at the time. But I could certainly see that because, you know, Germany was already fighting a hell of a war against the world's greatest enemy, the Bolsheviks. And now they were going to face the full force of the manufacturing ability of the United States. And a fanatic guiding that country. So certainly it had to condition people's mindset, and that includes the leader, the Führer himself.
Oh, sure. I agree with that woman. She's probably telling the truth,
mm-hmm.
that was a huge blow. But people saw it coming, but still. And then, you know, I was reading this article in the Inconvenient Journal, which I was going to talk about on Monday, but I didn't have time, about the death of Himmler. and why the British would have been the ones who killed him, because they didn't want him to tell what he knew and so on, about all of the peace feelers. And Himmler, it said there, of course, there's some evidence, you know, that Himmler started in 1941 making
overtures,
connecting with people in Sweden with some diplomat that he, and he thought that he was dealing with a real diplomat that was looking for some kind of connection with the Germans. And it turned out it was all along, as with Hitler's overtures and with Hess and so on, it was the British
intelligence.
Yeah, or executive, whatever they call that. Yeah, it was all British intelligence. But he started in 1941, but mostly it was in 1942. So that had to do with the United States coming into the war.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitler was, the way I see it, trying really hard to make everybody not get worried and not get afraid and, you know, say, we're going to win this, we're going to win this. He wasn't ready to give up like that, although he was busy trying to make peace with Britain, and then that would have included the United States too.
Yes.
Not knowing how absolutely impossible that was.
That's right.
To happen. But, I mean, it's, you know, this is what was going on behind the scenes. So I can see him while he's at dinner there and after dinner kind of taking it out on Christianity, because they sure weren't helping any, you know, or the churches.
And, you know, there were feelers going out.
And also thinking that this was weakening his people.
Yes.
That these Christian feelings, all this stuff that people who are critical of Christianity, all that stuff, and that's what he believed too, that it was weakening his people so that they couldn't stand firm and be tough, and he thought that they could, that they were sort of destined to win if they just stuck with, okay, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that's all right. I was just going to mention those peace feelers were, in 1943, when Germany by then could certainly see the writing on the wall, they started making peace feelers through the Vatican to the United States and England to, hey, you know, if you continue this, you can see that Russia is going to wind up ruling all of Europe and everything else, and we're willing to stop the fighting in the West or call a truce right there and turn all our efforts against Russia if you'll just get off our back and call an end to this fighting between us. And, of course, that was not going to happen because capitalism and communism are two heads of the same snake, as well as Zionism, of course. But, you know, Germany was smart enough to see that the only huge winner coming out of that was the United States and Russia primarily.
Yeah. Well, we did a lot of talking about this tonight, and we're going to stop here. So we'll say goodnight now. Ladies and gentlemen, please return with us next week for more exciting Hitler Talk here at Hitler's Table Talk.